Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Who better to take us for a tour of what's happening in the world of intelligence than our senior vice president at the Center for Security Policy. He specializes in policies and programs there. He is Fred Flights, but he brings to that job a wealth of experience in the intelligence community, including for 20 years in the Central Intelligence Agency. He also served in the State Department as the chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton and subsequently as a professional staff member under Chairman Pete Hoekstra on the House Intelligence Committee. Fred, it's so good to have you with us, especially as there is so much to talk about in the business of intelligence at the moment. Welcome back.
There is indeed. Good to be here, Frank.
I want to start with what is topic A for just about everybody at the moment, and that is James Comey and his firing from the job of director of the FBI. I know you've given a lot of thought to this, Fred, been commenting on it elsewhere. Give us your assessment of the advisability of, you know, putting him out to pasture by President Trump at this moment in time.
Well, my view is that Comey should have been fired on Mr. Trump's first day in office. You may remember last July when he went through that laundry list of security violations by Hillary Clinton and her staff, including very highly classified information found on her home server, her home computer server, carrying unsecured devices abroad. And then he said she shouldn't be prosecuted for it. The only reason she was a viable presidential candidate is because Comey did not make her follow the rules. And I think this really is the issue here. On top of that, this is an erratic man who every time he makes a public appearance, he talks about an investigation he can discuss and then others he can't discuss. And there seems to be no rhyme or reason for this. He's become a national embarrassment. I think the president got fed up with him. And, you know, if the president made a mistake, his mistake was he did not fire Comey on January 20th.
As a frequent guest on this program, Congressman Chris Stewart, a member of the House Intelligence Committee, put it elsewhere recently, you know, there was probably no good time to let him go. There would have been arguments had he done so, as you say, and I would have preferred at the very beginning that he was, you know, sort of engaged in a political witch hunt of sorts or a political action at the very least. But Fred Flights, in terms of the timing at the moment, Democratic critics and others are making much of the fact that here Comey is in the midst of an investigation. Why on earth would he do this now, an investigation that is of Donald Trump and allegations that his campaign was in some way, shape, or form involved with Russian efforts to subvert the election process? One question that has come up in my mind, and I wonder if you could comment on this, the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstern, has just come aboard as the new number two in the Justice Department and wrote a memo that it seems was sort of the action-forcing event here, calling for Comey's dismissal. Could that have had something to do with the timing? And if so, is that an appropriate basis for taking this step at this moment, do you think?
I don't know. It might have been the straw that broke the camel's back, this particular memo. I think that Trump's disgust with Comey has been building up over a long period of time. And for those who said, well, if you wanted to get rid of him, why didn't he do it on the 20th of January? You know, the president had to get his presidency settled. He had to get his people in line. I think now he's confident in his position. He has to focus on maybe some things he put off. My view is that, frankly, he got tired of Comey, his antics at a recent appearance before Congress, and it was about time to get rid of him.
There's much talk about what damage is being done by letting Comey go. I would ask you, to the extent you could share with us, insights from your sources inside the community, are you picking up what I am, which is that under Jim Comey's watch, morale had plummeted in the Bureau, in part, I think, for reasons having to do with those you've just mentioned, disgust at how he handled the Clinton affair and his erratic behavior on a whole host of matters of law as well as FBI practice.
That's the way I see it also. You're in one of these agencies. You don't want to see the head of the organization in the news constantly, particularly making all these controversial statements. He should not be the issue here. But there are some more important issues here. The law is supposed to be applied equally to everyone. And it seems if your name was Clinton, Comey did not think the security laws applied. And he created this new interpretation of the law where, well, let's see, if you violated the security laws, but you didn't have the intent to do anything wrong, Comey gave you a pass. Frank, if I did that, I'd be in jail. That's why I find this so offensive. You and I know people who have run up large legal bills on bogus charges brought during the Bush administration. I'm happy to say I wasn't one of them. But the Clintons were given a pass for this. And really, there should have been a serious investigation and I think jail time for some of these violations.
In the wake of Comey's dismissal, his number two, Andrew McCabe, has been promoted to the job of acting FBI director. I've been hearing for months about very profound concerns about McCabe, including about his partisanship, favoring the Clintons as well, and his enmity towards Donald Trump. Do you have a read on this guy, and how urgent is it that we get a new director in place who I hope would clean house in the top management of the FBI, not just with McCabe, but several layers down as well?
I've heard some reports like that. I don't know a lot about him, but we just have to assume that if there's a promotion from the swamp, if there's a promotion of somebody put in place by the Obama administration, look out. There's going to be trouble because, frankly, there's pressure on all these people to come after Trump, regardless of whether there's any reason to investigate Trump and his people or not. We really need to have an objective FBI director in place as soon as possible.
Yeah, amen. Fred Flights, you have a piece that's appeared today at Fox News that sort of touches on this question of the investigation into all of these affairs. Give us a read on what you've come up with.
Well, on January 6th, there was an intelligence community assessment that found not only that Russia intervened in the election, but did so specifically to help Trump win. We learned something very interesting from DNI Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence Clapper, in congressional testimony this week, that that estimate was not an intelligence community estimate by all 17 agencies. It was by handpicked analysts from three agencies. That's not the way these things are done, Frank. And first of all, I want to know how were these analysts handpicked? And after that was done, the heads of these agencies reviewed the findings, which means hyper-partisan former CIA Director John Brennan got to review and probably adjust the findings of this assessment. This has to be added to the congressional investigations of this issue.
Amen. And Fred, you know, I do want to mention that I think every time there was reference made to this set of findings, it was described as representing all 17 agencies, a unanimous consensus view of the intelligence community. What you've just suggested is to the contrary. It did not represent the collective view of the intelligence community, and it's not even clear all of the agencies that were involved would have come down on the same line. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, let's say it was three agencies, but it wasn't just three agencies. It was a handpicked group of about a dozen analysts. That's what Clapper said. This is news. This is big news. This is not the way these assessments are supposed to be written, and this has to be investigated.
Fred, lastly, the congressional response. You've spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill. I've been really struck by the flip-flopping and the speed which with the flip-flopping has taken place on the part of Democrats who just, I think, the day of the announcement of Comey's firing were denouncing his conduct. What's up with that, and where do you think this is likely to leave us?
It's just amazing. Just a few days ago, the Democrats all wanted Comey to resign. And now that Trump removed him, they're calling for impeachment. Whatever Trump does, the Democrats are going to be against it. And I frankly think the American people are going to be tired of these crying wolf complaints by the Senate Minority Leader and other leading Democrats to bash Trump and to claim some disaster or catastrophe is underway because of his policies every time he makes a decision. I just think they're losing credibility.
Fred Flights, thank you as always for the great work I know you're doing at the center these days and that you have done in our government in the past. We'll look forward to continuing our conversation on these issues with you next week. Next up, we'll speak with Daniel Horowitz, continue our conversation on Comey and more with him right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by one of the bright young stars in the conservative firmament, I believe, Daniel Horowitz. These days, he is a senior editor at Conservative Review, where he authors a column entitled The Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz. He has served in a variety of capacities in other estimable organizations in the conservative movement, the Madison Project, The Blaze, Breitbart among them. He is the author of an extraordinarily important and most timely book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel Horowitz, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, and definitely there's a lot of transformation taking place here.
There sure is. I want to talk about the transformation at the FBI. We were just discussing it with Fred Flights a moment ago, but I'd like to get your thoughts on this as well. For starters, we'll get into some of the substantive concerns about Comey, but just talk a bit about process and the histrionics that we're hearing from a lot of quarters about the president exercising what I think basically everybody agrees is within his purview.
No, absolutely. And this is something that's forgotten in our body politic, that the president is the chief executive officer of the executive branch of government. There's no such thing as an autonomous agency or department or office. If you're not part of this Congress and you're not part of the judiciary, well, you're part of the executive branch. So certainly he has that right to fire anyone. And in fact, I think if he made a mistake, the only mistake was the fact that he didn't fire him as well as other people earlier. I think the one weakness here, I certainly support his decision, he should have done this, but the one chink in his armor is the fact that he's really left a lot of Obama people in place, so it's drawn extra attention to the Comey fire in particular. But had he fired the IRS commissioner Koskinen, which he should have done from day one, Richard Cordray of that Dodd-Frank agency, and many other people, I mean, some of the deputies and assistant secretaries at the Pentagon, James Mattis is the only Trump appointee in the entire Pentagon. That's why it's really drawn extra attention. I think had he come in there from day one and told everyone you're fired, no one would try to drill down to any specific, firing and try to glean some sort of motive from it.
I agree with you that a house cleaning would have been helpful to reduce that problem, but it also would have been helpful to reduce the unbelievable internal difficulties the president has had with people nominally working for him in agency after agency. But one of the things that you've spoken to in your writings about the Comey dismissal was the necessity of having someone do what he didn't do, which is to take seriously and act seriously upon the enemy within problem. I've described it as Andy McCarthy does, as Sharia supremacism, by which we mean not simply, of course, the violent jihadists, but also the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about, why this is such an important item in the agenda as you see it.
Yeah, absolutely. What's very frustrating for some conservatives is that every issue somehow becomes adulterated by this Russia business. Everything's about Russia. Many of us joke around that if we want our important issues to gain some airing in the public, we should just have some sort of Russia connection. And that's the thing. As we look towards, a new FBI director and rectifying what was wrong with Comey, it's not just a matter of the fact that he was dishonest on the whole Hillary Clinton, email scandal, obviously being caught in the middle of the Trump-Russia investigation. We lose sight of the fact that the main job of the FBI director in this day and age is counter-jihad. It's protecting the homeland. Obviously, local crime is dealt with by local police departments. It's this international terrorism, the domestic homegrown Islamic terror. that is the purview of the FBI. And if you want to talk about the failures of Comey, I mean, that's where it's most glaring, from San Bernardino to Orlando, to the Columbus, Ohio State, jihadists there. Almost all of these people are what our buddy Patrick Poole calls known wolves. They were known to the FBI and they let them slip through. Why? Because of this politically correct culture of CVE, where they
countering violent extremism, right?
Countering violent extremism, where they obfuscate the Islamic source of terrorism, which is really, really a tactic of a broader goal of Islamic jihad, and say, hey, well, this could be anything. I don't know. Let me close my eyes. I don't know where to look. We don't know where to go in order to investigate.
Willful blindness, as you, among others, have called it. Exactly right.
That is the single most important issue that was lacking, really, with Comey and the entire culture of the FBI, as was the case with the Department of Homeland Security. And that's what we need to look at.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more. Andrew McCabe, the number two to Jim Comey, is now the acting director. My understanding is he is at least as culpable of this kind of willful blindness, or worse, and sort of active enabling of the Muslim Brotherhood types in our own country. Do you have any read on him, and how concerned are you that he's now running the store in Comey's absence?
You know, it's very concerning, and this is really the theme in almost every department where Obama's deputies or assistant secretaries are running the show well into 100 days of this administration. McCabe has ties to Terry McAuliffe. He literally is a Democrat. I mean, at least Comey was allegedly a Republican at some point, had a little bit more respect in conservative circles. So this makes things even worse. And again, putting aside his connections to Hillary and what he did with the investigation of Hillary's email scandal, that's an issue in itself. But there is no way a man like this even understands or is willing to learn the threat doctrine of our enemy, the problems with the Muslim Brotherhood, how they cultivate the climate of homegrown terror at home that has given birth to many of these domestic acts of Islamic terror we've seen over the last few years. So, I mean, he needs to fire him immediately. And again, we should immediately put forth a name that will speak directly to this and has experience in counterterrorism. You know, if Trump wants to get the Russia scandal off the front pages, you know, making the confirmation hearings about domestic Islamic terror is the best way of doing that.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Daniel, as I mentioned, you're the author of a book about judicial tyranny entitled Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. You've been describing a bit of the transformation that's been taking place. Explore with us quickly, if you would, the latest of this judicial tyranny business. We've got the immigration pause, executive orders being stopped. We've got the sanctuary cities order being stopped. We even have corrupt officials of the United States Veterans Administration being their firing being interfered with by, judicial imperialists. Give us a read quickly, if you would, Daniel Horowitz, on what all of this entails and what it portends.
You know, as I note in my book, the other two branches of government over the last number of decades has outsourced their powers to the courts, where basically there is nothing a court could do that will elicit a response, and it won't be regarded as the law of the land. So if a court could redefine marriage, redefine human sexuality, control every state redistricting map and election law, well, now they could redefine our borders and sovereignty. And that's what you're seeing now, where you have the specter of the Department of Justice groveling before a circuit court. And let's not forget, the circuit courts are created by Congress, not the Constitution. You know, it certainly don't stand above Congress and the executive branch, but they're groveling before them to please allow us to have a slowdown of immigration from countries with dangerous Islamic terrorists. I mean, it's unbelievable. And you had the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals this week hear oral arguments on the appeal. And you know, any indication seems to show that they will uphold the district court's ruling in so-called blocking Trump's executive order, because the overwhelming majority of them are Obama appointees. So this is a game we will never win. And this is why I've long advocated it's time for Trump to work with Congress to invoke Article 3, Section 2, which gives Congress the power to strip the courts of jurisdiction over varying subject matter, and certainly immigration is a great candidate.
This is a subject to which we will return with you soon, I hope. Daniel Horowitz of Conservative Review, thank you. Next up, Andrew Arthur of the Center for Immigration Studies joins us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
I'm very pleased to welcome for the first time, I believe, to Secure Freedom Radio, Andrew Arthur, also known as Art Arthur. These days, he is a resident fellow in law and policy at an institution I regard as among the most important in Washington, certainly in the non-governmental sector. It is the Center for Immigration Studies. He comes to this position with a distinguished record of public service in both the Congress of the United States and in the courts of Pennsylvania, and as a federal government official. Let me just tick these off. Staff Director of the National Security Subcommittee of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Also as an immigration judge in the York Immigration Court in Pennsylvania, and as the acting chief of what was then known as the Immigration and Naturalization Services National Security Law Division. A man of considerable distinction and great acumen on the issues we hope to address with him today. Art, it's good to have you with us. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Frank, it's good to talk to you today.
Thank you. Let me ask you, because you have had experience really, I guess, on both sides of the bench, if you will, about a couple of things that are important, of course, in the immigration space as a matter of policy, but they're also important as a matter of jurisprudence. I'm thinking specifically, for starters, of the immigration pause order, actually two of them that President Trump has issued as executive orders, and the travails that he's had ever since with the courts. Talk a little bit about your perceptions about both the justification for those orders, the need for them, and what is happening now in the federal judiciary.
Thank you. And I think that this is one of those areas that a lot of people just don't understand very well. When we're talking about individuals that come from most countries, we're able to do a lot of background before we allow them into the United States. If you are coming to the United States from Germany, consular officials in Berlin or Munich are able to, you know, check at the local city level or at the state level to verify your documents. The passport itself is a very secure document, and so we can be more or less sure that what you're telling us is true. In addition, there's a strong system of justice in most countries. Then we're able to verify whether or not you have engaged in criminal activity or whether you have any other characteristics that we may not view as valuable in either a non-immigrant or an immigrant to the United States. There are certain countries, however, countries that either don't have governments or that have governments that are openly hostile to the United States. And we have to deal with those countries in a slightly different way than we do with the vast majority of countries around the world. Somalia is a prime example. Somalia has been in the midst of a decades-long civil war, and for much of its existence recently, it hasn't had functioning governments. For that reason, there really aren't the sort of documents or systems that we're able to rely upon in order to assess and, you know, make determinations as to whether or not an individual who is seeking a visa or other benefit might have that would that we may not want in the United States, so that would render an individual inadmissible.
So this is something both within the authority of the president to do and to have good grounds for doing, it sounds like, when he's dealing with failed
Absolutely.
States and the like.
Yeah, it's not simply within the authority of the president, but it's incumbent upon the president to make sure that we have the appropriate checks in place to screen these people. And that was what President Trump was attempting to do. During his statements on the campaign trail, initially he said, you know, he made certain statements, but as he went along, he began to clarify them. And I believe that that clarification reflected his understanding. Following the terrorist attacks in Europe within the last 2 years, there became a concern in the United States that individuals who had carried out the sorts of individuals who carried out those attacks may actually attempt to come to the United States. And both the Obama administration and Congress addressed this with respect to certain individuals who would enter under the visa waiver program. President Trump's proposals built on that and reflected an understanding on his part or a growing awareness on his part, a refinement of his position, that this was an issue and that we needed to take steps in order to protect the American people from the minority of individuals, but still, you know, a concern who may come to the United States to do harm.
What have the federal judges who have been engaged in reviewing these executive orders done, and especially in finding that the president has acted unconstitutionally and they've interposed, you know, stays to prevent him from doing what, on the basis of what you've just said, which is, tracks with my understanding as well, is eminently needed and justified?
Congress has given the president the authority to do what he did, and the president acted appropriately in taking steps. The courts that have interposed themselves with respect to these orders have done so based upon, purportedly, statements that he made while on the campaign trail and statements that he's made as president. But this is exceptional. You have to understand, Frank, that when it comes to immigration, Congress is supreme, and when they give the authority to the president is supreme. We refer to the plenary power over immigration, and we've had 100-plus years of case law that has made it clear that the president and Congress have the authority to keep people out of the United States if they pose potential danger. These courts have turned that on its head. They've completely thrown out and ignored all of that case law to make their decision.
And we hope that a Supreme Court will be ruling in a manner consistent with the Constitution on this and supporting the president in the exercise of necessary powers, and particularly in the cases that you've mentioned of people coming from failed states. Let me ask you about another topic that you've commented upon. Again, our guest is Art Arthur, the Center for Immigration Studies. You've recently published a piece there, and I commend everybody. CIS.org is a resource for not only your work, but much else Mark Krikorian and your team is putting forward that helps us, the rest of us, understand these complex immigration issues. You've called attention to something that, frankly, I hadn't been really aware of, and that is the problem of aliens that have been apprehended after they've illegally come into this country and are claiming that they must not be removed once they've been, you know, discerned as illegals on the grounds that they have credible fears of being prosecuted or persecuted, I guess I should say, in their home countries. Talk a little bit about what's at issue here and why it's so important that we get our hands around this problem as well.
As important as the refugee issue is, Frank, the credible fear issue is even more important and poses a larger vulnerability to the American people. Refugees are screened before they come to the United States. Again, the level of screening is the issue. But we can always say no to a refugee if we have questions. When it comes to the credible fear process, credible fear kicks in when someone enters the United States illegally or presents themselves at a port of entry with no documents and asserts that they have a fear of harm if they return to their home country. What happens at that point is an asylum officer from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services will interview the alien and make a preliminary assessment of whether the person has a credible fear. The number of individuals who have claimed credible fear has exploded over the last 8 years in this country. And people have come to view this as a way to get a toehold in the United States. The problem with this population of people, though, is they're not pre-screened before they come into the United States, and in essence, they've been accepted into this country. The Obama administration, through a series of policies, would bring these people into the United States and, by and large, release them after a short period of time. The problem is that we really don't know that much about them and won't find out that much about them.
And unfortunately, this becomes a bit of an industry, I assume, whereas, I guess people claiming asylum, once the word is out that if you just say you've got a credible fear, you may well be able to stay and, as you say, be turned loose on society. This really does raise a host of hoary questions as to what we're doing with respect to these aliens. We are hard out of time, I'm afraid. We've got so much more to talk to you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. And I appreciate tremendously what you're doing at the Center for Immigration Studies, as well as your previous service to our country. Next up, we'll speak with Michel Garfinkel about the elections in France, what it might mean for the French, and perhaps the rest of us. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Michel Garfinkel, one of the great conservative intellects of France, who is these days the editor-in-chief emeritus of Valeurs Actuelles and the president and founder of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute. He contributes prolifically, I'm very pleased to say, to our thinking about issues of interest to him, notably France, but the sort of fate of the free world from his vantage point, in a variety of American publications as well, including PJ Media, the Middle East Quarterly, Commentary Magazine, American Interest. He is a fellow with the Distinguished Middle East Forum as well. Michel Garfinkel, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We spoke shortly before the election of your new president, Emmanuel Macron, and my recollection was that you were rather favorably disposed towards him, not keen for sure on his alternative, Marine Le Pen of the Front National. That seemed to be the fairly strong sentiment of your countrymen and women as well. Michel, tell us how the election looks now, a few days in the rearview mirror.
Well, there are a lot of points to be made. First of all, it has been agreed by all commentators that Macron led a very good campaign in the very last days, whereas Marine Le Pen, the leader of the National Front, was not as good as expected. Second, it's widely accepted that even if a lot of people voted for Macron just because they didn't like Marine Le Pen, nevertheless, Macron was able to garner a lot of support for himself and for his platform. And the third point is that the moment he was elected, something very important occurred in France. It is that, first of all, he has signaled his intention to nominate as prime minister, his first prime minister, somebody coming actually from the conservative right and not, as it was presumed, from the centrist or socialist parties. And we see a lot of conservatives saying either that what Macron says is no nonsense or saying in a different way that it would be pointless for some conservatives not to accept large parts of Macron's program if Macron is serious about what he says. So this is a very interesting moment in French political history. Of course, what we must keep in mind is that there is going to be a further ballot, so to say, in the election, since a parliamentary election is due to take place within 1 month.
Yeah. Well, let's pause on that for just for a moment. I do want to get deeper diving on that. But Michel, before we leave the past election, what you've just told us, which is very interesting, is that there will be a more balanced leadership than we might have thought. As yet, I guess, undetermined conservative will be brought in as the prime minister. Is that right? He hasn't named the individual yet?
The name of the guy is Mr. Philippe, who is the mayor of Le Havre, the big portuary city in northern France. He's a conservative. I wouldn't say he is a far-right conservative, but he is a conservative. And if he is indeed nominated, for the time being, Macron is not technically president yet. He's just president-elect. He will be president for good only this Sunday. So if he is nominated, it is a very important signal.
Yeah. All right. So if he does, in fact, balance his leadership a bit on this front, let's talk about some of the positions that Macron has taken, which presumably he now has a mandate to pursue, and how you see these playing out. And Michel, then we'll talk a little bit about the parliamentary elections. There are three that sort of stood out for me, and I think many of us on this side of the pond were troubled by, quite frankly, from a conservative point of view at least. One was sort of the willingness of Monsieur Macron to subordinate French sovereignty to the sort of EU project. This is a sort of larger issue, I guess, of globalism, which is a second problem for us. And then thirdly, his embrace of the Islamists in France. You indicated when we spoke last that he was embracing everybody, so not to read too much into the attitude towards sort of, what I think of as Sharia supremacism. But walk us through each of those, if you would, Michel Garfinkel.
Well, there is definitely a risk involved with the European Union to be transformed into a supranational entity and for the member states to gradually lose their sovereign rights. But so far, we have not reached that point yet. And it's not clear at all that Macron is just saying that he wants France to just disappear within a larger European Union. One must draw a distinction between what may happen and what we really have for the time being. There is no discussion that Macron is pro-Europe, but remember that not so long ago, most sound conservatives in Europe were pro-Europe.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
The only question is, what kind of Europe do you really have in mind? You know, and it's not very clear for the time being. And the facts are that there is a case for staying with Europe, maybe reforming Europe. And maybe in that sense, I'm not sure at all about what Mr. Macron is going to do, but one may imagine that there will be more convergence between him and Mrs. May in Britain than most people think.
Well, that will be most interesting. Let's talk quickly, Michel, because we're almost out of time, about the Islamists. Give me a sense on how you see him actually conducting himself in office vis-a-vis what, at least from my perspective, is a very serious challenge to the future of France, namely this large and increasingly aggressive Sharia-adherent population.
It's clear that Macron says, essentially, that we have a big Muslim community in France. It's a fact by now. Some people may have lots of second thoughts about this, but it's a fact. So what he says essentially is that he thinks that the dynamic France can do what is required in order to get these people into the mainstream of French society. There are certainly many people of the Muslim origin in France who share that view. But there is a growing proportion of the French Muslims or the French immigrant Muslim community that are getting more Muslims year after year. So again, one does not know exactly where we are.
Michel, we're going to have you back for a further conversation about how it's shaping up in practice. But we are hard out of time now, and I'm so grateful to you for taking a few minutes to walk us through the election. We'll come back to you in particular with respect to the upcoming parliamentary elections, which may shed light on where this is actually going to lead France and perhaps much of Europe as a result. Michel Garfinkel with Valeurs Actuelles and Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute, we're grateful for your time. Come back to us again very soon. Itamar Marcus joins us next.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by an old friend and much admired colleague. He is Itamar Marcus. He is the founder and president of a terrific organization based in Israel called Palestinian Media Watch. He is truly an extraordinary resource on one of the issues that has featured prominently, including last week in conversations between President Trump and Mahmoud Abbas. The president apparently in perpetuity of the Palestinian Authority, about a question that Palestinian Media Watch has done more than anyone else to document and warn of, namely incitement as official state policy in the Palestinian Authority, notably but not exclusively in the schools and among the population more generally. We've asked Itamar to join us to talk a bit about the conversation Donald Trump had with the Palestinian leader, as he's called, and what we should make of where we are on this issue of incitement and where we should go from here. Itamar Marcus, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Oh, thanks. Always great to be with you, Frank.
So the president made a priority of ending this incitement in the course of the campaign. I trust that you were gratified by that. Am I right?
Yes. This is something that we've been pointing out for years, and I just might introduce this by saying that the word incitement does not do justice for the severity of what we're talking about, the totality of the messaging we're talking about. When the Palestinian Authority names schools after terrorists, including three schools after the terrorists who murdered 37 civilians in a bus hijacking. They've got four schools named after Salah Khalaf, who planned the Olympic massacre of Israelis. These are arch terrorists, mass murderers, and children are going to schools named after them. So here we're talking about something as simple as the naming of schools, and we're realizing how it's impacting on a whole generation of Palestinian children.
I just wanted to get your reaction to a comment that President Abbas made to President Trump in the Oval Office. Quote, "I affirm to you that we are raising our youth, our children, and grandchildren in a culture of peace." How did you hear that comment by Abbas, and how should the rest of us think about it?
Well, that statement by Abbas that he's raising children toward peace is a total lie. We immediately released actually a video that people can see on our website, where we put a medley of different messages on all to children on Palestinian television, and most of them from children. And they include children reciting poems, Jews are monkeys and pigs, Jews are enemy of Zion is Satan with a tail, and many other examples like this, where the enemies of Allah, the Jews, the Zionists raped the women in the city squares. These are all children on children's programs, and in most cases afterwards, the moderator gives a bravo, bravo, bravo. Some of these we've heard as much as five and six times on different children's programs.
And one of the other pieces of this, if I'm not mistaken, Itamar, is that the sort of frequent refrain is these children are being encouraged to actually kill themselves to advance this jihad against the Jews. Am I right?
Absolutely. There's this concept in Islam, shahada, dying for Allah. And the Palestinian Authority for many, many years has been promoting this for its adults, and they also promote it for their children. And even this year, 2017, even in the last few weeks, we've had children on TV glorifying this desire for death.
Yeah. And to some extent, at least, as I understand it, Itamar, we have been complicit in this insofar as we are continuing as Americans and taxpayers, for that matter, in the funding of the Palestinian Authority. When you hear Abbas making this comment, should we ascribe this simply to the well-honed tradition of taqiyya on the part of sort of Sharia supremacists, that they can say anything that advances the faith, they can lie, especially to infidels? Or is there something even more sinister at work here insofar as this is a kind of classic subterfuge in terms of, you know, deluding the United States government into continuing to treat the Palestinians as partners for peace and people with whom we can safely make investments, including tax dollars?
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think since the establishment of the Palestinian Authority from the days of Yasser Arafat, there have been two messages, two different messages. One is the English language message from Arafat. It continued under Abbas. It is peaceful. It's we are victims. All we want is a little bit of land. The message to their own people is that it has nothing to do with land, or very little to do with land. It has to do with the essence of the evil of the Jewish people. And I'll just give you one simple quote. Just not so long ago, the person who Mahmoud Abbas appointed as his personal advisor on Islam and head of the religious courts, the Sharia courts for the Palestinian Authority, his name is Mahmoud al-Habash, said on television, "This conflict here in Palestine is not new. It's the historic conflict between good versus evil, truth versus falsehood, and falsehood and evil," meaning what the Jews represent, "have been connected and aligned with the devil and Satan, and therefore," he says, "Israel is Satan's project." And he says, "This is the conflict. It's Satan." So when you've got the most important religious leader and confidant of Mahmoud Abbas telling his people that this, that the problem is because Israel is Satan and allied with Satan, well, there is nothing that we can ever do. There's no land that we can give. There's no gesture that we can ever make other than to leave and disappear. That would satisfy a resolution of that problem. And this is the danger. It's much, much worse than incitement. This is an indoctrination to hatred and demonization.
Right. Itamar, in part, I think on the basis of this assurance by Mahmoud Abbas in his visit to the president, Mr. Trump expressed some heightened confidence, it seemed, in his ability to achieve what has eluded his predecessors quite consistently, namely a Middle East peace. I think he actually went so far as to say it's going to be easier than some people think. If you were advising the president, what would you tell him about dealing with Mahmoud Abbas and, you know, most especially the necessary preconditions for there to actually be a peace worthy of the name?
First of all, he's got to try to achieve peace and not try to achieve a peace agreement, a peace treaty. A peace treaty is easy. It's been elusive up till now, but it's a lot easier than getting real peace. And real peace will never happen until the Palestinian Authority prepare their people for peace. What's needed now is a peace education process for the next few years, long before we get to a peace process, a technical peace process of signing an agreement. If I'll give an extra special warning, if Mahmoud Abbas were to sign a peace deal with Israel this year and Israel were to withdraw to any territory resembling the 1967 ceasefire lines, the pre-1967 ceasefire lines, Israel would be in mortal danger for a number of reasons. One, every missile, every homemade missile that will be made in basements all throughout the West Bank will end up on the airport, which is just a few kilometers away, and that would isolate Israel from the rest of the world immediately. No insurance companies are gonna cover the cost. So Israel could be destroyed economically without very much effort. And I would say something even beyond that. Even if Mahmoud Abbas is sincere, even if he is, and I don't believe it for a second because I see what he tells his people and his children, but even if he were sincere about peace with Israel, I would say within one election cycle or two, Hamas would be elected for sure, for sure, and they would throw out the entire deal. So whatever happens, if we have a peace deal now with the people the way they are today, Hamas will be elected, by the way, the same way they were elected.
Itamar, I'm afraid we are hard out of time. So much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us very soon with further insights into the truth about what's going on here. Itamar, thank you for the terrific work you do. Keep it up. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.